Hello, this is Kevin Annett. You're listening to Here We Stand. This is May 6th, 2018. We are here once again bringing you live the movement to bring back common law, the common law revolution. Today is a special program. It's going out to activists in 9 countries who are organizing on the ground as we speak to disestablish criminal bodies of church, state, and corporation. The show today was actually recorded about a year and a half ago as part of a symposium, a series of online workshops on the common law given by myself, Kevin Annett, and Ryan Gable. It's going to be the main content of the show today, but prior to that, I wanted to share with you something that just came out of England, where we have a group operating on the ground. I won't say what city, because we tend to face attacks as soon as the word gets out about what we're doing. But let me just pass this on because it shows in practice what we're doing. This person was part of a group meeting in the city to conduct a workshop on the common law, how they can use the common law to convene a court in their town to bring various known child traffickers to trial when the police and the government agencies were colluding with them, as usual. So this woman was talking to me, and she said right in the middle of their meeting, they got a call from one of the homeless activists that they work with in that city in the Midlands of England. And they said, there's 60 people about to be evicted. This was like late at night. It turns out that even though these people had paid their rent, the slum landlord was throwing all 60 of them out on the street. They were mostly foreign students. So the people in the meeting, there was about a dozen of them in our common law group in the city, they all go barreling down the street and they confront the police and the landlord. And they say to the police, you better back off. You took an oath of allegiance to protect the people, not the slum landlord. And they're arguing with the police. They're defending these students who are literally about to be evicted out on the street. And suddenly the fire marshal approaches, and one of these leading activists goes over and starts talking to the fire marshal, talking about what a fire trap the place is, and below the normal standards for housing, etc. The fire marshal comes around and eventually listens and takes the side of the tenants. He orders the police to back off, and he orders the slum landlord to take his case to court that he had no authority to, conduct an illegal eviction when they'd already paid till June 10th, paid their rent. And then, get this, he appoints some of the activists in our group as his local marshals, so they had the right to monitor the building, make sure nobody was evicted, and until the issue went to court. So the folks who were talking to me on Skype about this were elated. They said, we were talking in theory about the common law, but then it was only when we went saw what was happening in our neighborhood, went down and defended these people on the ground and put the common law into practice by confronting the authorities and making them back off, that's when we realized the power we had. And so it really gave these folks a real charge, and they could see the whole movement going from theory into practice. Now, that example is very instructive for what we have to do. We can talk till we're blue in the face. We've all got different theories, but it's only when we put it into practice that it takes on meaning. Now, that's really the philosophy behind what you're going to hear about today. We're talking at a certain theoretical level at this point, but it's fuel to be used by people on the ground to defend people where they are, whether it's the homeless, people being evicted. We're all being attacked by this corporate state of church, state, big money, all working together. And we're going to have more reports in the coming weeks of people in Ireland, in Italy, especially people who are running with this, who are actually bringing in eviction orders against the Catholic Church. They're occupying church property. They're arresting known child trafficking priests. We're going to have more of this, especially from those two countries, Italy and Ireland, in the future. Again, you can follow our work. For those of you who are new to the show, listening for the first time, follow our work at the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State website, itccs.org. All of our shows are archived at bbsradio.com/herewestand. And of course, our definitive work on how these crimes began in Canada and how they continue around the world, you can find at our website, murderbydecree.com. Go to amazon.com, put my name, Kevin Annett, in. You'll see our recent 8 books about these and two very important books which you need to keep in mind in following this work in common law training is the Common Law Training Manual and the Whistleblower's Manual. Both of those you can get at Amazon.com under the name Kevin Annett. So without further ado, here is the program, the Common Law Workshop. Hope you appreciate it. Until next week when we're live again, stay strong, stay clear. Thank you.
And welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm Kevin Annett, back with Ryan Gable. It's November 27th, and we are back, as always, here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific. And follow us at itccs.org, also bbsradio.com. You can follow all the archive show at our Radio Free Canada site there. Well, this show today is especially important. It's going out for all of those individuals out there who think they're battling on alone. Well, you're not alone. We're part of a universal movement to reclaim our minds, the world, and the law for the people. To start with a quote from Thomas Paine that seems to sum this up, "An army of principles will penetrate where an army of soldiers cannot, for such is the irresistible nature of truth that all it asks and all it wants is the liberty of appearing. For one man in the truth makes a majority." So that's a reminder, one man, one woman, and the truth is all we need, and we build from there. Today we're going to do an online workshop on the common law. What is it? How can this revolution of reclaiming our nation start in our own communities? What is the procedure for convening common law courts? And how do we protect our liberties and our lives from a criminal corporatocracy that is operating everywhere now? Well, that's some of what we're going to get into today. And let me just bring on Ryan. Hello, Ryan. How are things down there in the States?
They're all right, although I guess it depends on how much you pay attention to the mainstream or alternative media. But overall, things are all right. Fundamentally, though, there is a great deal that is wrong.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to flag before we get into the workshop today and some of the discussion is there's stuff all over the news from Norway, from Canada, the U.S., Australia, of these police busts going on, the arrests of online child porn people, hundreds and hundreds of these people, child rapists who are meeting over the internet. Why do you think the upsurge right now, or is that just something the corporate media is doing for some reason?
Well, here in America in particular, there seems to be a great deal of dis or misinformation, primarily resulting because of the WikiLeaks emails from Podesta's and Clinton's and Uma Abedin, Anthony Weiner. However, I have seen this spreading around the world in terms of the information about how these so-called busts have been happening. I think one of the most recent ones I had seen was a massive bust for online child pornography in Scotland. And when you start putting these individual pieces together, you start to get a clearer picture that this is a global network, that these are not necessarily isolated cases. I think, to answer your question, two things. One, the more we pay attention to both mainstream and alternative media, the more we do our own investigation, our own research, connect the pieces together, the more it seems obvious. But, of course, to somebody who's not really paying that much attention, it might not seem that obvious. They might say, well, what are you talking about? I've never heard this before. On the other hand, I think as more and more of these revelations do come out, especially indicating that there are high-level politicians, businessmen, governments involved in this, churches, the Vatican, they have to play damage control. And so right. They take a small name and they run that name through the media, and then there's this social justification, this social movement that develops, and this guy's evil, this guy's abusing kids, he's trading child pornography. There needs to be something done. Put him in jail. And while all the public's attention is directed towards that individual or that group of people, the ones that really run the show, using blackmail and et cetera, are able to go on unabated. That's my point of view.
Right. Well, you know, and further on that, it's pretty clear that, you know, these police arrests don't just happen in the vacuum. They happen because a lot of this stuff has been brought out over the years. A classic case of that is after we convened our first common law court case in Europe, in 2013, and that, of course, was directly responsible for the resignation of a number of top Vatican officials, including Pope Benedict. Interpol acted on our evidence and arrested over 1,000 people, and they even freed 30 children, literally being held in cages in Brussels. Now, this is a result of what the people are doing. So one of the main points today that we want to hammer home with folks is that we are the law. The law is not something done to us. You know, we can reclaim the law and be that ourselves and bring about these changes. In other words, we're reclaiming that energy that's been given up or stolen from us. We take it back, and that's kind of one of the main points. It's also significant, I think, that we're focusing on this, because during December, what we want to do online, and I've been talking about this with various people across Canada, but folks are really wanting to actually try some cases on the air. That is, do a little mini court where we take an issue like child trafficking within the government system with the Children's Aid Society in Ontario or someplace like that, and actually bring out the charges, bring out the evidence online. And this, during December, is what we want to do more of. We want to give people a sense of what is it like to actually convene one of these courts, and how can we do it today in our own community. Another thing I just noticed on the calendar was on this date in the year 1095, Pope Urban II announced the First Crusade. Now, what's interesting about that, Ryan, and again relevant, is it was the First Crusade that allowed the Church to come up with this notion of doctrine of discovery, where they had the right, in justifying the Crusades, the Church established the idea of a worldwide papal jurisdiction, which gave the Pope the legal responsibility to realize the vision of a universal Christian commonwealth. What that meant is he could take anybody's land and nullify their rights. So in other words, this whole notion that started over 900 years ago today was what led to genocide and the idea that we had the right to do whatever we want to people who weren't like us. So I think, you know, that's something we can definitely remember today.
Yeah, it's very similar to the Monroe Doctrine, of course, Manifest Destiny. And I think one of the confusing aspects of this is when you look at, let's say, Aboriginal people that are exterminated through one means or another, we look at them as citizens, people with good intentions, people just living their lives, people like you and I. We look at them as human beings, of course. The people that are within these institutions that believe they have some type of superior power given to them by God, or at least that's the notion, they don't see natives, or anybody for that matter, especially if you're not Catholic, which means universal, as being human. So to exterminate them does not mean anything. It's no different than slaughtering animals for a burger at a fast food restaurant, as far as they're concerned. Right. That's what it seems like to me. Is that true?
Very much. And that's really what we want to get down to today. What is it? There's kind of three general things that we face when we're talking about how to act, not just talk about it, but actually create something new. There's the whole issue of knowledge. We need to know what we're talking about. We need to be able to be trained so that we can act on that knowledge. But there's a third piece, and that's the inner recovery we need to do. And here's a classic example. We just talked to a friend of ours this week who's, I won't say who he is or where he lives, but he's a very progressive guy. He knows all about the health industry, you know, very up to date on a lot of stuff. We just heard today that he's off going to church with his wife. They go to Catholic Church. And, we were shocked and we said, like, how can you do this? How can you give money? You don't put money in the collection plate. And he said, yeah, well, that's what you do. So how can someone be so aware in one area and then give money to these genocidal institutions? And he knows about this. He even gives my books to various people he knows and that. And yet he goes along and supports the system. This is what we talk about. We may think we're free. We may think we are in control of our own minds, but we're so habitualized in what we do that we seem to have lost the capacity to act in a way that's going to stir up things a bit. Like, that's the big fear that I remember him saying, well, I didn't want to cause any upset with my wife. So you just go along and fund a child trafficking institution. That's, you know, what are your thoughts before we delve into it? I just wanted your thoughts on that as well.
Well, my first notion is that the attitude seems to be one of Stockholm Syndrome, where people have become friendly with their captor. And the second one is someone is typically in a state of quid pro quo. They don't want to upset the established order because of course, fear. of what other people might say or do, and that fear is rooted in our innate human essence, our nature as human beings. We don't want to be excluded from a group because we're very social. And I think the system is able to play on that because the system knows that even if you're very aware as an individual and you don't take action to change whatever it is that you believe is wrong, most of the time the people that are not doing that, especially if they're very aware, are not doing it because of what's my wife going to think, what's my husband going to think, what are my kids going to think, am I going to be ousted at the family, you know, family dinner, whatever the case might be. So it's like an intellectual form of Stockholm syndrome, not wanting to, as some say, upset the apple cart. I think it's really based in this idea of fear and how we're so terrified of what might happen. But usually when we take that step and we speak out, we typically find more people that are aware. Because if Kevin, you were never to have spoken about this subject, kept your job and not have been slandered, you and I would have probably never met. Because likewise, if I would have never kept my mouth shut and never would have started asking questions even as a young kid about things that didn't make sense, people like you and me would never be connected.
Well, not only that, there'd never be an apology. There'd never be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission if I hadn't have taken
those
steps. So and it creates a tsunami over the years if you stay at it. And that's, I think it's a matter of there's a kind of a mental shift that has to happen. Instead of acting from the point of view, what's going to happen to me if I do something, we have to shift so it becomes, what's going to happen to all those other people out there if I don't do something? And that's really the kind of the theme, I guess you could say, of today. Let's get into this, Ryan. Let's talk, now, just for the listeners who, if you haven't, you know, heard us before on this topic, to some degree, we're basing this on something that's already online that we produced over the last couple of years. It's called the Common Law Community Training Manual. You can find it at itccs.org. That's the website of the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, itccs.org. It's right there in the right-hand column. You can follow some of the points we're going to be making. But I want to start by saying, you know, a simple definition of the common law is it's the law of nature. It's Edward Coke, who was one of the founders of modern jurisprudence in England, said once in 1622, he said, the law is the public conscience, and common law is but common reason. People sometimes call it customary law, too. The ways that people operate together over the centuries to secure their peace and their harmony as a community. Now, we're counterposing that, and there's two different worldviews going on. In common law, as was said in the founding fathers of America, the people have unalienable liberties because the people themselves are the source of sovereignty and law. People don't form a covenant with a government. A government is an abstraction. People form covenants with each other to create governments and create the courts and create the laws. But the source of everything is from ourselves. And that's something very counterposed to statute law, where government says, we are the source of authority, you have no inherent rights, we give you the rights and we can take them away. That comes from a very old idea. It comes from Roman civil law, where people were seen as chattels. They were seen as the property of somebody else. In a sense, everybody's a slave except the rulers. That's a very different notion of law, and we're contending all the time with those two different notions. They run right through every aspect of our lives and every aspect of government and the courts. So we realize that the common law is in a perpetual battle against this other notion of slavery. And one of the things, Ryan, that's compelling us to do this program, it's a very practical issue. We work with people all over Canada and the U.S. especially, who are trying to defend themselves every day against a rapacious system, you know, a corrupt court system. And two of the issues we focus on all the time are the abduction of children by the government system and the fraudulent taxation system and mortgage system, where people are systematically robbed by the system. So those are the two things that, you know, I just want to kick out on, off on, and, you know, we can carry on from that.
Well, I have a few different thoughts. Maybe I could ask you a question to get your opinion on. When you think about history, those who are informed about history, even those that go through a modern mainstream education type of system, in America in particular, there's this inverted view of our, quote, founding fathers, in the sense that, and I've heard this many times, well, our founding fathers are, that's another form of government that's trying to tell us how to live, so we don't actually need the Bill of Rights. Maybe you could speak on that for a moment and explain that the Bill of Rights are not necessarily rights that are given to you by government, but they're essentially written down, so it's not as easy to take them away, if that makes sense. It's kind of like the Magna Carta. They're innate human rights, and just because they're not written down doesn't mean you don't have them. Could you speak to that for a moment, if that makes sense?
Well, exactly. The Magna Carta is one example, but in any statement that comes out of this natural law, and the common law is a subset of natural law, which basically says, you know, the nature of the universe is that all things are placed in common, that energy or anything in creation is given to all equally. There isn't any natural hierarchy of one over the other. And therefore, these rights are inherent within us. Magna Carta and these other laws or bills are simply an expression of that, but they're not giving anything to anyone. These rights only exist when they're practiced. That's the point. We're not, and you know, the slaves, the way we're taught to think in our society is, oh, I'm born into this culture, I'm going to be given these benefits, as long as I pay my taxes and obey the laws, I'm going to be protected and given rights. And those rights will be protected by the police. I mean, that's how we're all raised to think. In fact, the reality is we have no rights until we practice them. And no power has the authority to take away those inherent rights from you, whether it be a religion, statute, a policeman, government, anyone. They cannot, as a matter of fact, that's why it says in the Constitution of the United States that Congress shall enact no law, which in the First Amendment, that revokes these fundamental liberties of free speech, etc., all that stuff. And so they're simply recognizing by that a common law precept that nobody can take it from you. Okay?
Yeah, that makes sense to me, and that's what I think is really a great deal of misinformation is spread about that. The fact that what we call rights are written down does not mean that we get these privileges or we get these rights because we pay our taxes or because we follow some archaic man-made rule that's been constructed. They're innate in human nature. That's what the common law is.
Right.
It's the law of creation, if you will. It's what everything
abides
by.
Exactly. And that's why one of the basic tenets of common law is the law shall do harm to no one, because the law doesn't exist to harm people or rule over them. It's to ensure their peace and well-being. Here's
right.
a quote from... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say not just protect or harm, but also to protect certain people from prosecution. They can use the law to their advantage so that they can commit crimes and never have to deal with the consequences of those actions.
Right. Well, that's part of it. We're going to probably get into that a little bit more later when we're talking about enforcement. I think that's a really important point. But let me just quote from, this is the first constitution. After the Mayflower Compact, there was a thing called the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut in the year 1639. And they refer to, it is ordered, sentenced, and decreed that there should be yearly held two general assemblies or courts. Now, the people's assembly there and the court are one and the same thing. Now, that's a very important thing that people don't realize. We've been brainwashed, if you like, to think, well, there's government over there, there's the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, in America at least. In Canada, there's no separation. That's all one crown authority. But in that three system of government, we think that the court is almost separate from government. It isn't. In fact, the original notion is that, and when you look at the Republic set up in England in 1649 by the Puritans, they said that Parliament is a standing court of justice. So the people gathered together established their own laws and established their own courts. And that's when we're talking about how we set up common law courts, it's got to be put in a bigger context of people reclaiming the political authority in their own community. And that's something people often forget. They're looking at it in a very segmented way, and they don't realize it's part of a bigger recognition that when people have the right to govern themselves and bring out their own laws, police their communities, arrest those people harming their children, etc. And when the police and the courts don't do it, we have an obligation to do it.
So do you think in some countries that have more what you might call rights than others, or just have any type of written down notion of rights, do you think that there's a bit of, whether it's on purpose or not, there's a form of misinformation in the teaching process of teaching the youth about what these rights actually are? Do you think that's done, or do you think that that's not done? Do you think that's on purpose or not on purpose? What are your thoughts?
I think it's definitely on purpose, but the thing to understand is when you're living in any kind of system. There doesn't have to be a lot of conscious manipulation going on. People have their own little cog within the system they're working on, and they don't see the bigger picture. And it's amazing when you deal with people in government or the churches or anything, the extent to which they're ignorant, because they only see their little piece of the pie. And what we're dealing with is a whole system, and it has a mind of its own almost. And you have to know how to navigate that rather than thinking, well, we're just fighting evil individuals all the time. That's really not how the system operates. We have to know how the machine operates, and that's one of the reasons that we're doing these workshops, to show people, well, how do you actually deal with the system? And I think that kind of leads us into the first point about why do we create common law courts in the first place, and how do we set it up? And I think the very first thing we need to look at is the first step. Let's take an issue like children are being trafficked, they're being harmed, the police aren't going to do anything about it because it's the child welfare system itself that's grabbing children continually. What do you do about that? And the first thing you do is you state a case, and that's what's called a notice of claim of right. A claim of right under the law is when you simply say, I have a grievance, I'm publicly declaring that this is an issue I want to adjudicate, I want this to be judged and action done on it, and I'm convening a court. You can do that, you just post a notice publicly, you say, here's my statement of claim of right, here's the guilty parties, here's the issues, I need a jury, and you put out a call.
And anybody can do this?
Anybody can do that. It's your right. You don't have to get authority from anybody to do it. Just say, I am invoking this. I am starting an action. And it's really amazing when you start that process, how people start coming out of the woodwork when you're activating people in that way and not looking vicariously to somebody else to do it for you.
That's right. I think that's so key. It goes back to what I was saying about Stockholm Syndrome and what you mentioned about the fear of how people operate. Once they know this, they still participate in the system because of what others might think or what others might do, how that might affect their life or their lifestyle. This idea that I can't do it because it's legal or it's illegal or it's lawful or it's unlawful, or you can do something because it's lawful or because it's legal, that idea is rooted in the source of the problem. You're allowed to do whatever you want. You're a free human being. There are consequences to your actions, sure, but to believe or to think that you cannot bring justice as a group, as a court, as you're saying, against somebody else who has committed a crime, where in the system that crime has been committed, the system is established and operated to cover up those crimes or to help those individuals who committed the crimes from ever seeing any form of prosecution for what they've done. It's up to the citizens to make those decisions. And I think we've really had our sense of willpower and our sense of integrity stripped away from us, so we do think in a manner that is consistent with apathy and lethargy, and all somebody else will deal with it. I don't have to worry about it.
Well, it's the first step again. I think the way ideas and conditioning don't change in the abstract. They don't change by us looking at a laptop and reading articles. They happen in practice. One hour experience going up against the system is worth years of education because it teaches you right away the way things are. And just on that point, before we move on, about people doing it for themselves, I want to remind people that even under the present laws, the statute law of the corporatocracy, every country has what's called right of citizens arrest laws. And interestingly, in Canada, the power citizens have, even under Canadian law as it stands now, the power to arrest people has been broadened recently. There's a new statute law actually brought in 2012 in Canada, called the Citizens Arrest and Self-Defense Act. And under that act, previously, you could only make a citizen arrest if you saw a crime happening and there wasn't a cop around. Now, citizens in Canada can detain anyone who either commits a crime or is even suspected of having done so or might do so. Somebody who might pose a threat to somebody, we can arrest them as a citizen. Now, just think for a moment. We know that every Catholic priest in the world is governed by this law, Crimen Solicitanus, which says child rape is to be covered up, you're not to tell the police. That makes every Catholic priest in the world part of a criminal conspiracy. If a child's harmed in their church, they're to cover it up. Well, there's nothing stopping any citizen in the world from going into any Catholic church and saying, I'm detaining this Catholic priest because he's involved in a criminal conspiracy that might harm our children. I mean, the possibilities of action are mind-boggling. And that isn't even using common law. That's using a statute that exists under the present system.
Now, that statute that exists now, the so-called laws that are being changed in Canada, for someone to arrest another person as a citizen's arrest, is that just a citizen's arrest, or does that go for government and the RCMP too? Can they just arrest somebody on suspicion? Because that's, of course, very dangerous.
There's no restriction in the legislation. It doesn't say you can't do it to this person or that person. It's an open-ended thing. Now, of course, here's an example. On the West Coast now, in Surrey, British Columbia, there's a group operating called Creep Catchers. And you might see them if you do a Google search. The Creep Catchers hunt child traffickers and people looking at child porn online. They set them up. They try to make a meeting where they can meet underage kids. And then when the person comes, they're arrested. And they've got videos online of them chasing this cop down the road. In fact, they just busted a Mountie RCMP officer in Surrey, British Columbia, because he was caught by these Creep Catchers. And now the RCMP says they're going to investigate the guy and everything because he had online porn, child porn. Now, that's an example of citizens' direct action. But again, it's targeting individuals. It's not targeting a whole system, which is kind of our focus. But again, the principle is there. We have the right to detain anybody who poses a threat to our communities. Now, that could think of any corporate malfeasance going on, anyone in government, anyone in the church. All of them pose threats. So the sky's the limit, right?
Yeah, and maybe I have another question. Maybe you could speak on this just for a brief moment in relationship to this hypothetical court case. When you're talking about child pornography online or child trafficking or child abuse in general, there's a difference. There's a great divide between those people that are actually sexually attracted to children and those that do it for money or for power or those that are blackmailed into it. But this is multi-leveled, correct?
Well, yeah, and the reality is, as you know, rape is not an act of passion. Rape is an act of violence. It's the same, too, when it has to come to, you know, with children and adults. Any form of sexuality with the child is a form of domination, control, and violence. And you don't make a distinction under the law. Well, he didn't, and this is often how child rapists try to get off. They said, well, I thought the person was consenting, even though they're only 6 years old. I mean, so we really don't make those distinctions when it comes to something like that.
Right, okay. I didn't think so, but I wanted people to understand that there is a big difference. When you say pedophile, it usually becomes an all-encompassing word that means somebody who is attracted to a child, somebody who's sexually abusing a child for pleasure. Often it's not for pleasure. In fact, most of the time it's not for pleasure. It's for power, it's domination, or in the cases of the very high ups, it's for money, massive amounts of money and power and black.
Well, don't forget the word itself is an engineered word. It's a socially engineered word to get us to belittle the crime. Pedophile in Greek means friend of children. Philia is a Greek word, one of the three words for love, friendship.
Yep.
So every time you say the word pedophile, it's been drummed in your head. It means a friend of a child, not someone raping a child, but a friend of a child. So I start using the word pedicide. Side means kill, to murder. And that's really what we're doing. We're murdering innocence, and we should call it that.
That's right. Ped means child. In a simple definition, ped means child. Philia means love, which is in the sense of brotherly love, Philadelphia.
Yep.
Pedophile means lover of child or child lover, and you're exactly right. It's the use of language that can detract from what is actually happening. It can prevent us from really having a great understanding. And I think the same thing goes with the person's name as well, because names, especially when we go back into the history of looking what a name actually means, giving you dominion over something like Adam in the Garden of Eden or in an exorcism, naming the demon gives you dominion over it. Our names as individuals represented within this corporate structure, both in America and around the world, essentially identifies us as property, and slaves cannot own property. And that's a separate subject, but a key point.
It's all related, but let's get back to where we started on this, which was we're talking about convening a common law court and how anyone can do it. There's a statement of claim of right, but then after that, you put out a call for a jury, and it can be on any issue. I remember last year in California, I was working with some people who wanted to convene a common law court case into, there were two issues on their mind. There was the smart meters, and there was also, of course, chemtrails. And one of my advice to them on the whole chemtrail thing is, first of all, it's kind of big. And when you're convening a court case, you have to ask a very practical question. Can I prove it? Can I get the evidence? Can I name the names? Can I actually bring people to trial responsible for these things? Because if you can't, there's no point starting a court case. So we have to really think strategically in terms of who and what we're aiming at and whether we can get a conviction, whether we can actually bring in enough evidence to convict these people. That's kind of a very important point we have to keep in mind.
So that's a starting point. That is where we should begin when we start to think about convening a court.
Exactly. Like, in other words, don't aim too high. Think of who you're going to charge, what are you going to charge them with, how are you going to react when they don't respond. And one of the simple things to do, because we're in a minority situation right now. We don't have a lot of people on board. We have the power of ideas, the power of principles, as Tom Paine said, but we don't have a lot of resources right now. So what we do with these courts is we turn them into public forums. We invite everybody in. And this is the power of it. We announce, okay, we know who the child traffickers are in our neighborhood. We know who these corrupt cops are, whoever. We're naming them. We're calling them into court. The court's going to convene on this date in a public place. And public place could be a library. It could be a community hall. It's going to be an accessible place that people can come and be witnesses to. Because don't forget, common law has universal jurisdiction, and it's a public process from start to finish. We don't have secret court records. Everything is open to the public. And the public, in fact, because we need to rely on them to enforce the verdict of the court. And we're going to get to that under enforcement. So we invite everybody in. We say, let's put them on trial. And the very fact of doing that is a tremendous psychological advantage, because as soon as you do that, it doesn't matter what kind of power and authority they have, the defendant is on the defense, and they have to justify the charges being made against them.
Now, I'm just curious, how do you prevent against some form of kangaroo court in the case of common law? Because I would believe that those that are participating or want to do something about chemtrails, about child trafficking, typically have this conviction in mind already. How do you prevent that, or is that just a natural byproduct of the human condition?
Very good question. In fact, what you do is you operate according to rules of evidence and normal due process. So, for example, when we tried the first group, I call them the Dirty 30, there were 30 defendants in Canada and a few other countries who were accused of genocide. And we issued summonses to them, including to Joseph Ratzinger, Elizabeth Windsor, and others. And we gave them 30 days to respond. We said, we're charging you with this. You know, here's your chance to give your side of the story. And we waited for them to respond. And even after they didn't respond, which under the law is an admission of guilt often, a judge, if the defendants don't respond, often a judge will simply award the case to the plaintiff. But even after they didn't respond, we presented the evidence, we again gave them a chance to respond to the evidence in public, and they didn't. And so how you avoid it becoming just a vendetta is you operate according to rules of evidence. That means we assume the defendants are innocent, not guilty. The evidence we present has to be verifiable. It isn't hearsay. It's got to be backed up with eyewitnesses and documentation. In other words, there's got to be a basis in provable facts and as many eyewitnesses as you can find. So, in other words, we just operate according to the rules of evidence. And another distinction about the way common law operates is it doesn't believe in representation. That is, in the common law courts, there aren't lawyers representing people. In fact, lawyers don't really have a role any more than judges do, except as legal advisors. The case has to be presented by the people themselves. We don't believe that the truth should be mediated through another party.
Now, through that process, once we have convened a court, how do we go about presenting the evidence? Is it like a normal court, or is it different because it's obviously a form of common law? It's not within this very constrictive system. How do we go about actually presenting evidence, taking the next step?
Well, first of all, if you've got a case, you've got to do your research. You need a whole research team. You need people to go out there and get the hard evidence. And once you've compiled the case, there's a chance. It's called voir dire, which means to see and say. Sometimes in America they call it examination for discovery. There's a pre-trial meeting where you invite in all the sides and you say, okay, let's look at the evidence. Maybe we can settle this out of court. And if the people who you're naming do respond, you might settle it right there before even going to trial. But assuming that the examination doesn't happen, which is, in many cases, you know, people won't respond, you then go forward and you present your case in court. And the court is set up just the way you see on TV. You've got a judge, but we don't call him a judge. He's an adjudicator. And the difference is an adjudicator brings parties together and is their advisor. They advise, the adjudicator will sit up there and advise people on points of law. But they do not have the power to overrule the jury. And don't forget, the center of the common law court is the jury, the 12 or more men and women who decide the case. Because we know that people have the inherent ability to judge right from wrong. And when you present a case to people, they will come out with a just verdict. That's the whole premise of natural law, that people know what's right, and they can judge for themselves. So the adjudicator, both sides are presented, they present their case, and you have a court reporter, you have a bailiff, you have all of the things that you need to ensure the integrity of the court.
Now, once you have done this, Kevin, or maybe we can even take a moment to go back to look at the origins of the common law and common law courts. Was this modern day legal system sort of extracted from the common law? Because the common law is natural law. The process by which we go through to convict somebody through the innate knowing of what is wrong and right, was this basically, this legal system we have today, was this stolen, or was this an adaptation of the common law, or is it something entirely different?
Do you mean the jury system, or what specifically?
Well, the jury system, the means by which we go to court, there's a judge, the jury's there, we have lawyers. I mean, is this just all a fabrication as opposed to what we perceive as the common law?
No, it's kind of an amalgam. It, when you look at the modern court, it's really the result of these different traditions. On the one hand, you have, like, the jury comes out of the, really, common law came out of the tribal system in Northern Europe, as opposed to the Roman system of law. Now, the Roman system of law is what's called the civil law, or the Napoleonic Code in France. You get it in Quebec as well, because Canada really has two sets of laws, common law in English Canada, the Napoleonic Code or civil law, in Quebec, and civil law simply says law is statute. The government brings in a law and it's enacted. There's no such thing as precedent, legal precedent, which you get on the common law, where the very important principle in the common law is called stare decisis, which in Latin means the decision stands. So, in other words, that's a bulwark against a king or a judge coming in and saying, no, I'm throwing that case out. The rule of the state is more important. The common law says that once a decision is made by a jury, really, by a court, once they come up with a verdict, you can't overturn that verdict. As a matter of fact, even the appeal system has been grossly corrupted. So anybody with money can buy an appeal and get the verdict reversed. That isn't what happens in common law. This is very important in the common law court procedure. When a verdict is decided and a sentence is brought in by a jury, you can't appeal it. Because an appeal assumes that they've made a mistake somehow. And if 12 men and women are given all the facts, they're not influenced, they see all the evidence, their decision will be a just one. And you know, you've got to go on that basis. Now, if it can be shown that not enough evidence was shown or there was a manipulation of the jury or the evidence going on, then yes, you can reopen the case. But normally the appeal process isn't even there. And like I say, it's the jury that's the center. Now, that, again, comes right out of common law, the tribal tradition in really Saxon Europe. And it's mixed in with all this Roman influence as well, which kind of elevates the judge above everybody else and all that as kind of the representative of the state. Like in Canada, where all the judges are appointed, you know. So anyway, it's that kind of amalgam of different traditions.
So it's a mutation and a combination of several traditions. Okay, mm-hmm. That makes sense. So now that we presented evidence, we've gone through the research process, we presented the evidence, is it just like a normal court as we would perceive it, coming to a conclusion, a just conclusion based on the evidence, and then from that point, how do we go about attempting to enforce this? And maybe you could answer also, how do we prevent infiltration of others that might be on trial, but, you know, obviously absentee in most cases? How do we prevent infiltration and disruption of the process?
Well, that's where the whole thing of the importance of your own peace officers, and in terms of not only enforcement, but the protection of the court, you need these peace officers from the very beginning. That's why often in training with people in different countries and that, I say to them, the first thing you need to do is to swear in your common law sheriffs. Their job is to protect the court, to serve the summonses, to make the citizen arrests, if need be, to bring people into court when there's a summons against them, to organize the enforcement of the verdict. All of that requires common law sheriffs. I remember in the 16th century, there was a legal scholar, Hugh Grotius, and he actually came up with the first law of the sea, where he was looking at, you know, how to establish legal boundaries between different maritime jurisdictions, but, you know, different nations. Hugh Grotius said, the law without cannon fire behind it is an empty vessel. And in other words, what he meant by that is you can't just have a verdict. You need power behind it. You've got to have a way to enforce it. Otherwise, it's just a symbolic statement, has no power. And, you know, so that's very important to keep in mind. You need your common law sheriffs trained, and this is a serious responsibility. Once that verdict is in, it's up to that common law sheriff not to do the enforcement by themselves, but in effect to organize the community to make sure the enforcement happens. And that's a unique aspect of the common law. We get people educated, we bring them into the court, we say, now it's up to us to make sure that this enforcement happens. And we've got a verdict, we've got an arrest, we've got to go get these people, detain them, stop this practice, whatever it is, from happening.
One of the questions that I'm asked quite often, and I'm sure you are, is although there have been convictions of those such as Ratzinger, Queen of England, these are some of the bigger names, why have they not been brought to justice? And of course, it's sort of a double-sided question, because the answer is they have been brought to justice in one sense. They've been convicted, but why are they not in chains? Why are they not in a prison cell somewhere? Why has this not happened?
Well, I turn the question back on the people, and I'd say, why haven't you made it happen? Because the responsibility isn't on a few of us. The responsibility is on all of us. Why are you paying their taxes? Why are you involved in their system? Why are you not going and arresting these people yourselves? It's our responsibility to do these things. And, you know, in another sense, they have been arrested. The Vatican and the monarchy of England have been on the defensive ever since that verdict came out in 2013. You had four top officials resign. And here's another example of our power. On April 20th, it was Easter Sunday, April 20th, 2014, there was issued in Europe, and I was there in Maastricht, Holland, I was part of this ceremony, we issued a global emancipation proclamation which declared the Vatican to be null and void as an authority. And here's part of it, let me read it. All Church of Rome officials and agents, commencing with Jorge Bergoglio, so-called pontiff of the Church of Rome, every cardinal of the Roman Curia, and Adolfo Pichon, Chief Superior of the Jesuit Order, are hereby ordered to immediately stand down from and relinquish their office. That was April 20th. May 20th, he did. Adolfo Pichon stood down. He announced he wasn't going to be running for re-election. Now, do you think that's coincidental that after he's issued a public order over the airwaves to stand down, he then does? Clearly,
of course.
You know, the Black Pope there recognizes the power of that verdict, because he knows that any court in the world can issue an arrest warrant based on a common law verdict, and that's our power. Any other court can act on what we're doing.
And the same went for Ratzinger. According to Vatican officials, after Ratzinger stepped down, he couldn't leave the Vatican because he openly said he would be put on trial, although they made it seem like it didn't happen, but he would be put on trial for his involvement in the trafficking of children through the church. I mean, that was pretty mainstream news when that happened, but of course it wasn't connected to the actual common law verdict.
Well, this is my point, Ryan. Like, the proof is right there. It's the elephant sitting in the living room. We brought down these people, and yet people are going, oh, no, we couldn't have. We haven't physically gone and put the cuffs on them. I mean, that's really ridiculous when you look at it, and it's really a statement about people's slave thinking. Not until somebody in the system says something has happened does it happen in their minds. And this is part of the reclaiming of our own minds. It's such an important part of everything we're talking about here.
That's exactly right. We have to reclaim our own essential being. We have to reclaim responsibility, and I think responsibility is a key aspect of this as individuals and collectively as individual societies or cultures in our own local communities. Responsibility is so key, and I think it's that lack of responsibility due to the apathy that's been provided by our modern conveniences and by a conditioning that this could never happen to us. I think there's a word for it. It's called normalization. Things just always have been this way, and they're always going to be this way. And even though they might not be pristine, if we change them, things could get worse. So we might as well accept the way things are right now. So it's like a circular form of logic, it seems, Kevin,
right.
Although we have proven time and time again that this process by which you're explaining has worked. It just might not bring about the type of conclusion that we would be privy to by watching a movie or by watching Law and Order on TV.
Partly it's a quick fix mentality that would be the 3-minute soundbite. People want a quick solution to something, but they don't realize that to bring down a system of power, it's a lifetime effort. We're in this for the long haul, and I really want to emphasize that to people listening. You've got to take this knowledge and act on it every day. You've got to change the priorities of your life from a 9-to-5 existence, wage slave existence, into taking responsibility all the time for these things. And that's how we create something new. And I know we've got about 10 minutes left here. I want to just remind people that next week we'll be carrying on with more of this if you're free, Ryan, because we've got a number of things we've still got to go into that haven't been and won't be covered today in terms of time. But another thing I want to flag with this, if you go back to the whole issue of enforcement, here's a question somebody had sent me from back east. They said, okay, we've got a verdict, we're going to enforce it. What do you do when the cops show up? And I've got some practical experience in what you do with the police, because police are governed by statute and by their superior. And all you say to them, and we have one of our documents in our common law training manual, is I'm going to pull it out here, a notice and warrant to deputize, issued under the authority of the Sheriff's Office of the Common Law Court of Justice. To all peace officers and law or statute enforcement officials, this public notice is issued to you as a lawful warrant, placing you under the jurisdiction of the Common Law Court of Justice and deputizing you as its officers. Upon taking this oath, you are empowered to act as the lawful agents and protectors of the court in its proceedings and to enforce its writs, warrants, summonses, and court orders. If you choose not to take this oath of office, you are compelled and ordered by the court to refrain from interfering with the actions of other officers so deputized. If you intervene, disrupt, or impede the actions of this court or its officers, you can and will be charged with criminal assault and obstruction of justice. That's what you hand to the police. You say, we're deputizing you to be a common law agent. You're a peace officer. You should enforce the will of the people. And if you try to stop us, you're assaulting us and you're obstructing justice, and we can charge you. Now, we have done this. We did it a number of times in Vancouver when the cops showed up when we were doing the church occupations. All we did was, we didn't even have to say that, although we did on one other occasion. All I said was, I went to the sergeant and I said, this is a criminally convicted church. They traffic children. It's their policy to do that. Are you seriously going to stand in the way of us peacefully protesting here? He turned around and he left. He told his guys to back off. So, in other words, when you stand up against the system peacefully and with the truth, they know it's true and they back off. That's been my experience.
From your own experience as well, to play on that point here just for a moment before the show is over this evening, for most of us, and I've been doing this for about 5-6 years, but for others who are just now aware of what's happening in this realm that we're discussing, maybe relating to child trafficking, pedophilia, etc., we're not necessarily seeing maybe as much of a drastic change as someone like you who's been doing this for decades has seen. So for us, it might not seem as if things are changing, but for you, from the time you started to become aware of what was happening, church and state, in Canada in particular, what have you seen develop? Has there been a drastic change?
It's kind of like the Kennedy assassination. Everybody knows that it was a vast conspiracy, but the official version is still Lee Harvey Oswald did it. The system will never acknowledge. The system is never going to come out and acknowledge to us what we're saying. because it works through psychological warfare. It always works to make us feel insignificant. The reality is you've got to stop looking at the system and look at our own common sense and what we know is true. And I'm telling you, over the last 20 years, we have brought about, and a handful of us in Canada did this, we brought about a revolution. We got Canada to acknowledge that it committed genocide. You know, since when is the system ever going to do that? And it was only a couple of dozen of us who did that, because we did what, in The Art of War, General Sun Tzu says, it doesn't matter what your size is. What matters is, A, what the power the enemy thinks you have, so it's psychological warfare, and B, it's where you are strategically and with what persistence you act. And if you're at the right place, it's not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of action at the right moment in the right time. And this is, you know, the power, again, of the common law court. You've got to find the right issue in the right moment, and you can literally bring the walls of Jericho down. And we've done it, you know. So we need to take confidence in that, right?
That's exactly right, Kevin. That's right. So now that we've got a bit of an understanding, we're going to continue this discussion next week in relation to the common law, correct?
Yeah, and I want also, I was talking to some people back east, and they want to, in Winnipeg and Ottawa, the folks there are actively involved in taking on the Children's Aid Society and Child and Family Services, and they're trafficking, open trafficking of children. So they're going to be bringing in some evidence about that, and I'd like to use next week as kind of almost an online trial where let's put out the evidence, let's name the names, let's do a mini trial on that issue of child trafficking, and we can then apply some of the ideas we're talking about today. Here's how we actually go about it, because I think a practical example is a lot more educational than simply talking in the abstract about these things. We need concrete names. You know, the old saying, evil has an address. Well, we'll name the address, we'll name the people, and we can do that next week for sure.
Excellent. That sounds great. And I would suggest for anybody who is interested in this subject, maybe you know and maybe you don't know, I think that the key foundation before you can really go any further, from especially what we've discussed this evening, is to have a fundamental understanding of natural law, of common law, of this idea, this erroneous idea that somebody could own a human being or own a piece of land or own a lake or own a river. These are not things that you can own. You cannot buy and sell them. You cannot buy planets and sell planets, as some very wealthy elitists in the world are now suggesting that you can buy property on the moon. These are not things that you can buy. This is natural law. This is common law. I think understanding these fundamental concepts will make it much easier to break the paradigm for which those may believe it is possible to bring about justice to the people who have committed these crimes on such a global scale.
Well, you have no natural authority over anyone else. You have no right to do more of the earth than anybody else, and you have an obligation to be at peace with others. And those are the three tenets of common law, and we act on them. That's the whole point. It's how we act on them that matters. And we've only got about a minute left, so let me just say thank you again, Ryan. Do you have any announcements of your own you want to make?
Yeah, actually, I have a great guest on my radio program tonight, The Secret Teachings. I have three shows a week live, Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday. They also re-air. And this evening, I have Cynthia Brewer on the broadcast, and she covers a subject that is very similar to this, although in a completely different capacity. She was one of the unwitting and unwilling participants in the Human Genome Project for cloning, and her story goes hand-in-hand with the stories of Kurt Kallenbach and Jordan Maxwell in relationship to human beings being patented, cloned, and used as property. This also connects to the Vatican. So she will be talking about that for almost the entire show with me tonight. You can find that at www.thesecretteachings.info. There's links, plenty of dozens and dozens of links, different places.
All right. Thank you, Ryan, as always. And please, all the listeners, tune in next week for a continuation of this with a practical expression of how we convene one of these courts. 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, bbsradio.com/radiofreecanada. Follow our work at itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, and also keep an eye open on amazon.com for all of our books, Unrelenting, Murder by Decree, Whistleblower's Manual, The Truth Teller's Shield, and an upcoming book, History of White People in Canada, which is kind of comical. And I'll talk about more of that next week. But until next week, take this all to heart, drink from this cup, and carry on humanity's oldest battle, brothers and sisters. Until then, stay strong and clear. Thank you.